The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. You may have noticed that I was away last week, but no, I wasn't sunbathing in a London park. I was in Italy as a moderator of the 2011 Book Tomorrow conference. Organised by UNESCO, it was a talking shop for several hundred delegates from all over the world. Academics, librarians, writers and publishers descended on the grand 19th century pile, the Villa Reale, just outside Milan, for 3 days in an attempt to work out what the future of the written word might be. You can understand why.
Death of the book. Publishers will become interactive media artists. SEObook.com.
It is an immutable law that the death of the book must be debated at least once a year. The book is an artifact of the heart. Because the mind responds more viscerally and profoundly to words on paper, it gets an emotional charge, a deep connection with the characters, a yearning desire to know the ending. That is not found on a screen. Tanya Kindersley.
Physical books don't work anymore, especially in the developing world. They're a complete luxury and it makes no sense. Nicholas Negroponte.
UK Lit Festivals defy the death of the print book phenomenon. Publishing Perspectives.
Tech pundits recently moved up the date for the death of the book to sometime around 2015, inspired largely by the rapid adoption of the iPad and the success of Amazon's Kindle e-reader. Technology Review from MIT.
Francesco Bandarin is UNESCO's Assistant Director General for Culture. He explains why they decided to stage this conference.
We saw that the discussion on the future of the book is not done in the proper format. It's normally very antagonistic. It's a collision of interests. So some people become very defensive, like, for instance, big libraries or governments, so they don't like the power of Google, of Amazon, and so on. And I don't think we didn't think that this was the proper way to deal with such an important thing. So this is essentially conceived as a forum in which all the actors that have a role in this transformation of the book are called upon and are put in a forum so they can discuss, express their views, perhaps find new avenues. You know, the book is the most important cultural object of humanity. It's changing, not necessarily in the same way in all the countries, but it's changing. There is still a little bit of a fog on where it's going. There's no clear understanding of how this transition will lead. So I think it's important in this phase of discussion and you know, to put everybody together. Whatever happens to the book, whatever happens to its format, to its future, the values that we as UNESCO embody and represent have to be put up front. We're not talking about a commercial product, period. We are talking about something that is very important for education, for human development, for communication, for knowledge, for exchange among peoples and cultures. So it's not just an object, it's something more. And this something more has to respect and embody the values that we support, which is, of course, humanistic values, access, freedom of access to information and education, and of course, freedom in terms also of expression of the authors and so on. So all this we will watch, because it's very important that these values are preserved. The death of the book has been pronounced prematurely. There's no death of the book. On the contrary, if you go to certain areas of the world, the book is living an extraordinary season. Try and go to Brazil. Try and go to China, where you know the publishing business is thriving and booming. So we're not talking about death of the book. We're talking about a landscape where you know you have certain changes in certain areas and certain ups and certain downs. It's very articulate. The book is here to stay. It's here to stay both as a physical object, we'll always have books around us, and most of all as a content.
Francesco Bandarin doing a welcome bit of cheerleading there. The forum, as he called it, was short but intense, with a miasma of discussions to choose from. And it wasn't always easy to decide which session to pick, as the Irish commentator Owen Purcell found out.
I think I'm going to go to the copyright versus copyleft, which is the first workshop.
What does that mean, copyright versus copyleft?
I'm not entirely sure, but I'm very interested to find out. I think a sense of kind of a more open copyright or a slightly less restrictive copyright that's not maybe based on the licensing system of fair use and Creative Commons.
So what are the alternatives you could go to?
Well, actually, funnily enough, the second one is fair use and Creative Commons, and there's a third one on preserving digital memory, which I'm not too convinced by, so I don't...
Why are you not going to that?
I just don't think it'll work out in the end, because it requires too much collective action and too many sensible decisions for the long term, which I don't think we're very good at making. So I don't think there's much hope for us preserving the digital archive very well.
But we've heard lots of things about very optimistic projects setting up huge, great libraries of books. Do you think that's all sort of ridiculously optimistic?
Well, I think probably for major works, we will see quite good archiving projects. I think where we will lose out in the digital world is emails, documents that aren't necessarily of enormous importance on a day-to-day basis, but in the longer term might be interesting for historical research or things like that.
Well, let's go into the conference.
Well, I decided on copyright versus copyleft, at least partly to enjoy the Richard Stallman show. He's a veteran open access activist who spent the forum handing out iBad stickers, dissing Berlusconi, and at one point picking a loud quarrel with police outside the convent housing Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper. At the level of anecdote, the whole conference was a revelatory experience. I learned about the smartphone smarts of South Korea, where an astonishing 82% of the population now go on to higher education, books for the blind in Ethiopia, unravelling e-texts in US university libraries, and a huge copyright row in India involving turmeric. And yes, you did hear correctly. Common or garden turmeric became the focus of a legal fight over free access to traditional Indian medical wisdom. But for some, it was crucial not to let the confusion and contradictions get in the way of a job to be done. Here's a publisher from Africa.
I'm co-manager of a Présence Africaine Édition, which is a publishing house with African and Caribbean books. Well, the future of books, I think the problem should not be addressed the same concerning West and South. For instance, in Africa, not everyone can have books, traditional books. So, as you know, also the mobile phone is very well spread in Africa. So we can also imagine that electronic books, maybe the future of electronic books in Africa can be quickly achieved. It can be foolish to say that now, but nobody could think 20 years ago that mobile phone would be so used in Africa, so much used.
One thing everyone agreed was that real problems are being posed by the clash of technologies that faces writers, publishers and academics from day to day. Most significantly, the endless battles to protect copyright. That's the burden of a high school teacher of journalism from Palo Alto, California, Esther Wojcicki. She's now vice chair of Creative Commons, an organisation devoted to making sense of copyright on the World Wide Web.
If we had what we used to have, 25 years ago, if we had books in hard copy format, the publisher publishes the book, it's got copyright, nobody else can make another copy of it. That whole system works. But today, there's so much material on the web, and it's just out there, and you can just highlight it and copy it and put it in your own blog, or you can just print it off. So copyright doesn't work anymore. It is something from another century. They have had 17,000 lawsuits, the RIAA, Recording Institute of America, and what good did it do? It didn't do any good. You can't sue the whole world. You can't sue all the users. So we have to devise some system that people are going to buy into. They'll understand the reasoning behind it, and then they're going to cooperate. So Creative Commons gives people an option to buy into it. And I, as an author, I can label my stuff with Creative Commons licensing. Not all of it, maybe just a chapter, two chapters, part of it, just to give people an idea and allow them to copy some of it or to share some of it. And then it just enables people to follow the law. Today we're training a whole generation of teenagers to not follow the law. They're all stealing stuff. They all know they're doing it, but they're like, oh, what the heck, I'll never get caught. And they don't get caught. The alternative to copyright is piracy.
So Esther's Creative Commons solution, an idea that really is spreading, is to give away partial copyright so people don't have to ask. But when they want more or the full work, then they have to come to her to pay. Interestingly, this school teacher, even though she may get her essays by electronic email, has seen no signs of her students wanting to do without books altogether.
Nobody really wants to read a book online, and nobody really wants to copy a whole book. Can you imagine printing out a 320-page book on 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper? Never. So nobody's really going to do that. They take little snippets of the book. So if you give them permission in advance, then they act like sort of PR agents for you, because they're taking part of your book and they're putting it on their blog. And then if you have a license on it, the smallest thing they're supposed to do is attribute it to you. So then your stuff travels all over the web.
And further evidence that books are not going to be wiped out entirely by digitization comes from one of Latin America's most successful digital publishers, Octavio Kulesh from Argentina. He's almost back to the methods of Caxton, however, when it comes to the business of producing an actual book.
When in 1999, I started with my brother our first project, Libros del Zorzal. And thanks to that project, we went to the UK in 2006, invited by the British Council, Publishing Entrepreneur of the Year. And we were selected as the Argentinian Young Publishers. As I saw many prototypes of e-readers, and well, everyone was talking about the e-book as something that was going to come soon. And I came back and decided to open another publishing house, a new unit, fully devoted to e-books and print-on-demand. So at that moment, it was the first fully digital, or I say digital not just for the e-books, but also I include print-on-demand. First digital publishing house from Argentina and from Latin America. And as we didn't use any warehouse or stock, the publishing house, my aim was that the publishing house should be my phone or my laptop, and thus to avoid problems of stocks and logistics and so on. And that's how we set up a veritable network of printers. We don't own the machines, we just sign contracts with different providers. In Latin America, then also we work, we sell through Amazon in the US, and now in Spain. So books are printed one by one. And with ebooks, we have different distributors, and it's going very, very well.
How do you have enough resources to actually put work into editing? This is one thing that's been raised a lot, is actually the care of the manuscript on the way to being published.
We have quite a large team. Freelancers, and so we have the capacity of working on 3 titles a month, or to work on 20 titles a month. It depends on the, and a business unit which is very strong now is publishing the research material of the main universities in Argentina, such as a National Library, 3 or 4 main universities and other institutions. So that gives us a lot of strength in commercial terms to work on other materials that we publish on our own. So it's quite a small team. It's a 5-people team, but there are lots of freelancers, and it's a very flexible structure.
So publication of books in the fully digital age is back to one by one. James Bridle of the East London-based design partnership The Really Useful Group has gone even further. He's scornful of those who are fearful of the digital age, but his experiments have taken him in some surprising directions.
One of my main interests while I'm here is following up and talking about a project called Open Bookmarks, which is trying to look at what happens to the experience of reading once everyone's reading ebooks. It's had a slight odd character, the conference so far. A lot of the speeches have been about Gutenberg, which seems like a strange thing to be doing when we're here to discuss the book tomorrow. There's still a sense of almost denial that ebooks and electronic reading is really happening. But also here are delegates from Google and Amazon, who are already well into designing what reading is now actually about. I'm concerned that the publishing industry and literature is kind of being totally shaped by the new technologies rather than by the reading experience that publishing and the publishing industry has a huge amount of experience in. So I'm trying to sort of take the publishing discussion towards how people read and how they'll continue to read in the future and our relationship with the book.
Tell us about some of the projects that you've done. I was particularly interested in your collection of the Wikipedia experience of Iraq.
So last year I took the complete edit history of a single article on Wikipedia, which was the history of the Iraq War. Wikipedia stores every change that's made to every article on it. So you can look back through the whole history of the way the article is constructed. It turns out that when you make a complete record of that entire history of a single article and print it out in a book form, it takes the size of a traditional old encyclopedia. It's 12 very large, weighty volumes. But what that is a kind of visualization of the way we now construct knowledge in public. That there's a whole historiography of a single event, the Iraq War, and a popular historiography. So there's important arguments about casualty figures and what elements of the news are going to be important for future generations. There's also a lot of people shouting and writing abuse, and those things are now recorded as part of the general discourse as well. What's interesting about it is it's not so much a history of the Iraq War, it's a history of the way in which we construct our understanding of the Iraq War. A lot of the internet now, slowly, we forget the internet's 20 years old and actually has history to it now. And it's starting to become a repository, not just of knowledge, but of our ideas about knowledge. That's going to be one of the ways in which I think we increasingly come to understand ourselves through the network over the next however many years.
Ah, how refreshing. Someone talking about the reading experience. So what about the writers? Not many of them at the conference, to tell the truth, but I did see a small group huddling together over lunch. Their worldwide support network is International Pen, whose next president is the Canadian John Ralston Saul. He said he felt a bit like a patient in a hospital, the body that everyone around him was talking about operating on.
I don't go to many conferences like this, you know, but I think it's a wonderful conference. There are some fascinating people, but it is interesting. There are only about three or four of us who actually make a living being full-time writers, independent writers. It's mainly, you know, academics and industry people and civil servants and activists in favor of the e-book and things. And that's great. It would be very interesting to have a dozen writers who gave their views on what it sounds like to sit here and be talked about. You know, there is a real problem. I think most of us feel that we'll find ways to maintain the independence of the writers, which income. But I would say that a lot of the experts, particularly the ones who are very excited about technology, have absolutely no idea what a book is and don't read. Some of them don't seem to understand the nature of freedom of expression. They just see it as a technical problem or a commercial problem. And of course, we'll exist whether the commerce is there or not. We'll find a way. We're the people who have to find the way and break through. And there are some courageous publishers who are like that and some courageous journalists who are like that.
And off he rushed to answer another international phone call and engage in the worldwide battle. He's not terribly optimistic. But there are optimists, plenty of writers among them, who've already engaged in the new media with gusto. Foremost at this conference was Harvard professor Robert Darnton.
In general, I'm trying to get across the notion that we live in a complicated time, obviously, but there's a tendency today to over-dramatize the nature of things, you know, to say the book is dead. I have been invited to so many conferences on the death of the book that I think it's very much alive. There are more books being published each year than the year before worldwide. In the year 2011, there will be at least 1 million new titles published. And in Britain, you had the famous Super Thursday last October. You published 800 new books in one day. The production of books in Britain has gone up 40% since, I think, 2001. I'm not saying that things are booming. I know that publishers complain about hard times, but the fact is that the good old venerable codex, the printed codex, is doing very well, thank you. So I think that people are misled when they say the book is dead. And similarly, you often hear it said, all information is available online. That's absurd. Anyone who's done research in archives knows that a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of material has been read, not to mention reproduced. In a sense, the future is digital, but at present, there are many forms of communication which are not digital at all. So we live in a period of transition in which the analog and the digital coexist, and I think complement one another. There's this tendency to treat e-books and old books as if they occupied opposite and antagonistic extremes on some kind of technological spectrum. I think that's quite false. And there are many examples of how these two means of communication actually complement one another, including exciting new kinds of books, which can be hybrids, part printed, part electronic, with electronic supplements, etc. I don't want to lapse into self-advertising, but I must admit I'm very excited about a book I recently published with the Harvard University Press. It's an academic book, but written for the general reader. It concerns street songs in Paris in the middle of the 18th century. Now, this was a society without really a press. There were newspapers, but they didn't have much news in them. It was a highly illiterate society. How did people find out what was happening? Well, largely through songs. In fact, a contemporary wit said, France is an absolute monarchy tempered by songs. Why? Well, because people wrote or improvised new verses to old tunes every day. I found thousands of copies of new verses. A friend of mine is a cabaret singer in Paris, Hélène Delaveau. She actually recorded the songs, and we made them available online for free. This means that the reader of the book can turn to an appendix, get the texts in English and in French of a dozen songs, and then listen to them online. And it's a way, so to speak, of recovering sound from the past.
Quelle est son festin public et son pique-nique? Non, c'est un gueuleton donné, dit-on, pour célébrer la paix. Et de ses beaux appareils, la ville fait exprès les ferrets. Quelle finesse, quel goût règne partout! Quels éclatants effets font ces buffets! Et ce donjon doré bien décoré est un temple sacré.
As Robert said, that's an 18th century street ballad sung by Hélène Delaveau, available free on the internet as a supplement to his book Poetry and the Police in 18th Century Paris.
Quel est ce festin public et ce pique-nique? Non, c'est un gueuleton de l'éditeur.
Mario was a humble postman who lived a simple life on a small Italian island. For years, he loved Beatrice, but he just didn't know how to tell her. Until Pablo Neruda, the famous poet and world-renowned romantic, moved in. Now this great man is about to teach him that every moment has its meaning.
The Postman, or Il Postino, is a celebrated novel by the Chilean writer Antonio Skarmeta. He's seen this work translated into every possible medium, onto film, the web, and now even opera. It has led him a merry dance all over the world. He now feels much like a pop singer who puts his work out and then spends the rest of his time doing gigs.
The appearance of the e-book and all these other tools, I think it's a very good occasion to bring democracy into the distribution of culture. For a long time, for decades, the e-books or all electronic devices are going to live together with the paper book, because the paper book has many other qualities besides being written word. It's an object with so many things, people who make the drawings, the fact that the book appears, and at the same time, everybody is concentrated on that book. If it's an interesting, an exciting book, immediately the whole world will speak at that. I think with the electronic book, it will take quite a long time until this public excitement arises. There is also a need of being together with somebody, closeness, an intimacy. This relation with the artist is needed. Of course, a singer does it much better than a writer. But I see as a writer and my colleagues, we have been invited in the last time all over the world to meet people, to face the audience, to bring the warmth of our voice, our gestures to the people, to talk to them, to sign books. Real books is now something magic. The moment you stay just 1 minute or 2 minutes looking at the face of somebody who asks you to sign a book, and he, she tells you something about the life, the names, or whatsoever, it's a magic moment for people. People are angry for two things: more information and more intimacy.
So, 3 days of banter. Did I come away any wiser? Well, I know a lot more about the problems, but solutions? If only. The one thing I am pretty sure of is that come tablet, scroll or smartphone, the written, edited word will remain the cornerstone of everything we value. As UNESCO's Francesco Bandarin said, the book remains the most important cultural artefact of humanity. So from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, the book is dead. Long live the book.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.